Hello, listeners. My name's Cody Starkin, and welcome to a very important episode of Standing Post. This month, we're featuring a courageous individual who will tell her personal story of survival during the Oklahoma City bombing on April 19, 1995, almost 25 years ago as of this recording. We want to let our listeners know we recorded this episode on location at the Oklahoma City field office, so once again, you may hear some ambient noises during the recording. The crew here at Standing Post also wants to take a moment to say thank you to all the people around the world who are on the front lines every day to prevent the spread of COVID-19. To the healthcare workers, first responders, activated military forces, and those individuals who still have to go into work each day so the rest of us can stay home safely, you are the true heroes. Thank you for your efforts from the bottom of our hearts. We hope the show provides a much-needed break while you continue your efforts. Now, please welcome our special guest, Administrative Officer Priscilla Salyers. Priscilla, welcome to Standing Post. We appreciate you coming on the show this morning. We're fortunate enough to be in Oklahoma City to have this interview in your conference room, and I'm humbled and honored to have you on the show. But before we start, do you mind introducing yourself to the listeners?
I am Priscilla Salyers, the Administrative Officer of the Oklahoma City Field Office.
And how long have you been in that position for?
I came back to the Secret Service in 95. So I've been here for almost 25 years, but I had worked here about 6.5 years before that.
And where did you go in between those times?
I worked at federal probation. I stayed home. I quit Secret Service the first time because of I had to stay home and help my husband with his business. So I always wanted to come back to the Secret Service.
What did you do between your times when you first started with the Secret Service and after the Secret Service?
I worked for the Secret Service. I started in 1978, and I worked for about six and a half years, and then I had to quit for personal reasons. I stayed home to help my husband with his business, and then I went back to the government. I went to federal probation. A couple years later, I went to U.S. Customs Service, and they were located in the Murrah Building.
And what attracted you to the Secret Service? Was it just how did you find out about it, and what made you join?
When I first moved to Oklahoma, I heard somebody had a job at the Secret Service, and I got interested, and when there was an opening, I applied.
Okay. And so did you just go to the field office?
I went to the field office we were called field office clerks at that time.
How old were you at the time when the incident occurred?
44.
Okay. And you've always been in Oklahoma City field office?
Yes, I have always been in Oklahoma City field office. Like I said, I started in 1978. I had to quit in 84, and then I came back in 95.
There's a reason why we have you on the show today. We wanted to talk to you about April 19, 1995, the Oklahoma City bombing that occurred on that date. And I know it can be tough sometimes to speak about it, but I really appreciate your time to come on and to kind of go through what happened to you, because it's a very interesting story, a very challenging and unique story that I think not a lot of people know about, and we wanted the opportunity to tell that story. So would you be willing to kind of walk us through just about the morning of how that day started for you?
Sure. I at the time, I worked for U.S. Customs, and I was the first one in the office. I was going to go down and check the mail because that's what I usually did, but I didn't want to have to lock the office back up. I was going to wait till the agents came in. Paul Ice came in, and we were sitting in his office talking. And a few minutes later, the other agent came in, which was Claude Medeiros. He walked in, and he went straight to his desk. And when we looked up, and I said, I need to get back to work. So I went back to my desk. I was sitting there. Paul walked up behind me, and he was looking over my shoulder because I had files in front of me, and he was asking me questions. The phone rang, and I went to reach for it. But before I could pick it up, we heard this horrible, horrible explosion. It was like a sonic boom that I remember as a child hearing sonic booms. There was not even enough time to wonder what happened. We locked eye contact, and that was the last time I saw him. I started falling. I didn't know I was falling, but it felt like a whirlwind. I could see stars, like when you get up too fast. I couldn't understand what was happening, and I thought maybe I'm having a seizure. It went on, it seemed like forever, very loud whirlwind noise. And then it stopped, which basically I had landed. When everything got real quiet, and I thought I had a heart attack. And I'm like, no, I'm not hurting. I'm trying to figure out what is going on. And I laying there trying to get oriented, and I heard a voice, and someone said, this is a child care center. And there was a response, we know, we're trying to get you out. And my mind is just trying to take this all in. I thought, child care center is on the second floor, I'm on the fifth. I did not know I had fallen down into the basement. My fall was not like a free fall. The fireman explained that it was like taking the slide. So I just went down with everything. But I thought I was still sitting at my desk. Paul was there. Claude was there. They're going to come help get this furniture off of me. And all I could move was my left arm. And I was reaching out, trying to find my computer, trying to figure out what's going on. And I went around behind me, and I went, oh, no, my dress is up over my waist. And I was just humiliated because I knew the guys were going to be there. Then it was still real quiet, and I'm still trying to figure out where are they, what's going on, because I could not hear anything. As I'm getting oriented, I'm going back and forth. This isn't really happening. And your mind just takes over. Then I realize, okay, I can't move. I can't get out. The pressure on my head was so tight. I had gum in my mouth. I couldn't even spit it out. Oh. All I could move, like I said, was my left arm. So I'm trying to figure out what is going on. And all of a sudden, I heard somebody close by. And I started beating my left hand on the rocks because I didn't want them to miss me. And the man took my hand. And as soon as he took my hand, I just felt this peace. Even though I didn't realize what was going on, just having someone there, I knew, okay, I don't have to worry anymore. He said, do you know why you're down here? My first thought was, down here? What are you talking about? Because I thought I'm still on the fifth floor. And he said, we think there's a gas explosion. We're trying to find out. I didn't realize I'm in this cave, and he's speaking to me, so I could barely hear him. Mm-hmm. But a little while later, he said, I have to leave. And I didn't want him to leave. I just wanted somebody to hold my hand because I knew I was going to be okay. And he said, no, I have to leave. And I was getting a little angry, and I'm like, don't leave me. And then his voice cracked. And when his voice cracked, I knew something's wrong, and I let his hand go, and he left. I did not know that they were pulled away from me and forced to leave because there was a second bomb scare. And I'm so thankful I didn't know about a bomb scare. Mm. But they were gone a long time. And I'm down there and for about 2 hours. I did not know how long, but I was down there waiting for them to come back. And I'm thinking, where did they have to go to get this tool? You know, what's taking them so long? I got very angry at them for leaving me. So I thought, I don't need them. I'm going to get myself out of here. So I did like the Incredible Hulk thing, and I started laughing because that didn't work. And I kept going back and forth, like, this isn't real. And then I would go back to realizing, okay, something's terribly wrong. I would pray, and I asked the Lord to keep me calm and give me the wisdom for survival. And what came to me was I had recently heard about some people from Japan that had been found in an air pocket after 9 days. So I realized, okay, I need to make sure I can breathe. So I was able to take my hand and kind of put it under my chin and pull debris out from under me and make sure that I could breathe. And then I would go back to like, this isn't really happening. Wait till I get home and tell my family what a bad day I've had. So, you know, I thought it was just me. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I couldn't hear any voices. People would ask me, like, didn't you hear all the sirens? Didn't you hear all this? And I said, I did not hear anything unless they were right there in that little cave area. I tried different things. I was getting hot. I tried to take my arm out of my jacket, and my hand got stuck, and I started laughing at myself again. You know, the only thing you can move, and you're acting silly, so you got to quit. And I would calm down, and I would breathe real slow. Then I went back and forth, getting mad and then saying, okay, you got to behave. But then I felt a lump under my stomach, and this was probably way, like an hour or so later, I realized there was, and I thought it was a rock. I am so angry, I want to get this rock out. And I reached under me, and my hand felt another hand. And I clasped it, I held it. It was not my arm. And I just assumed it was my coworker's because he had been standing there with me. And I held that hand, and I just remember, okay, this is why they're not coming to get me out of here, because they're here with me. I don't know what happened. So I'm waiting, and I hear voices again. And, okay, I could tell somebody was around. They're not going to miss me. I'm mad, and I'm pounding. And they, once again, we have a live one here. And they took my hand. When they're trying to get me out, I could barely hear them talking. I could hear a woman that I had not heard before, but I heard a woman begging them to help her, and she was crying. And they kept saying, you got to calm down. You got to stay calm. We're going to get you. I learned later that she died, and they knew she was dying, so they were trying to get all the live people out, you know. So they told me that they had to use the jaws of life and the chains to get me out. There was a column on my head. They said, the firemen told me they only had to move it like a quarter of an inch to get me out from under it. And it was a 3-foot by 5-foot column, but it was like 25 feet tall. And when you think of the scheme of things that I fell, and I have these 4 floors coming down on top of me, it's just a true miracle. They were able to pull me out from under this column, and they flipped me over. I also had a piece of metal wrapped around my ankle because we had the metal in the walls, and they didn't know how I got out of there without having my foot cut off. So they got the metal off of me. They flipped me over, and when they flipped me over, the pain was so excruciating because the blood started coming back. And I felt like my chest was crushed, and it was just horrible. And I looked to my left, and I'm still thinking I'm on the 5th floor, and I looked to my left, and it reminded me of when my parents used to take us to the caves, and you would see the stalactites and all the things in the cave. Well, I could see firemen climbing over all this stuff, and it's not making sense. And I looked up. I could see the sky. Why am I seeing the sky? They took me out the 2nd floor in the back, which is where the daycare center was. And when I looked up, I could see right through the ATF windows, and they were on the 9th floor, and nothing is making sense at all. They got me to the hospital in ICU. I had a punctured lung, broken ribs, and I had that cut on my ankle. I looked like I had been beaten up with a baseball bat, but that's nothing compared to what I went through. I remember being in ICU, and I had the TV on, and I'm watching the news, and I'm going, oh, those poor people. I couldn't even realize I had been right in the middle of that. I would see people that I knew that had worked in the building, and I recognized all of them, but I still couldn't figure out what had happened. Or I think I just wasn't wanting to accept what had happened.
Okay. And during that time under the rubble— like you were talking about the different things that you were going through and what you were experiencing. Was there anything that helped you keep the strength to work through that event?
My faith kept me. And I kept going back when I would realize something bad has happened. I kept going back and praying, just keep me calm, give me wisdom. I've often said that I mean, coming out of it and being a survivor was very, very difficult. I often wonder if I would have fought so hard if I had known I had would have to go through all the emotional, mental part of it. But I'm glad I did. So.
How long were you under the rubble?
I was trapped for 4.5 hours.
Okay. During your time in the ICU and getting better, as you're working through everything, how long did that take for you to be able to recover?
I was in the hospital for just 5 days because I had, you know, my big thing was the broken ribs, and they can't do anything for you. So I was released and went home and suffered with my broken ribs.
We met a gentleman, a chaplain, Chaplain Jack Poe, and he had influence on your life. Would you be able to talk to the listeners about that relationship you had with him?
Yes, Jack Poe was the Oklahoma City chaplain, PD chaplain. So after the bombing, when we met Jack Poe, we just took him in, you know, as part of our family. He served as our chaplain unofficially for the last 25 years until the chaplaincy program started with the Secret Service, and now he's an official chaplain. But he was very significant in everything that went on, like the trials. I remember that when the sentencing came down for McVeigh, I went down to the site, and he was down there, and he was helping everybody. And he just was involved in everything with the jury, but the trials. He's been very significant in our lives.
And what does he mean to you personally?
He's a good friend. His wife is a chaplain as well, and so I've known them for 25 years.
So how long did it take for you to return back to the office? Was there any challenges with having to return?
I was given the automatic 45 days off that you get with workers' comp, and I stayed home for the 45 days, but I had to get focused. I called the office and asked if I could come back, and they told me, you can get another 45 days. It's no problem. And I said, no, I've got to stay focused. I need to know what day it is. I went back to work. It was very difficult because my two coworkers were gone. It's hard to focus. You've got short-term memory. You've got all the stuff that happens when you go through a trauma. But I was determined. I remembered I had 3 time cards to do. It took me the whole day, but at the end of the day, I was like, I did it. I did it.
And so as time goes on and you continue moving forward with your life at that point, did you find yourself sharing your story a lot? Did individuals, when they were coming into the office, did they know your story and do they approach you?
When we get new employees, they probably hear from other people that, you know, I'm a survivor. I don't normally just bring it up, but I am more than willing to share it, and I have shared it with the agents, and I have no problem with them asking me any questions.
25 years later, we're here, we're talking. The anniversary is coming up here in April, so technically not 25 years, but we're getting there. Who are you today, Priscilla? Who are you as a person resulting from this event?
When this happened to me, one of my worst things was survivor's guilt. I wanted to come back to Secret Service. I had always wanted to come back to Secret Service. And after this happened, one of the agents called and asked me if I'd come back. And I said, I can't. I felt guilty because Linda and Kathy were gone. And he said, Prissy, you know that they would be the first ones to tell you to get in line. And I did come back. It was hard. Like, when their families would come to the office, I felt guilty. I'm here because they're not. But the families were wonderful, and they always welcomed me. I shared stories with them about their loved ones. And I worked hard. I got through the survivor's guilt. I decided I'm going to make Kathy and Linda proud of me. So I got back into the office and picked up the pieces. Life goes on. I try to give people hope. I'm much stronger than I was. When all of this happened, I never focused on the individuals who did this. I wasn't going to let them rule my life. I worked to get my joy back because I thought if I don't get my joy back, if I don't get up and live life, then I've done injustice to those who died. And I also let the terrorists win, and I was determined they weren't going to win. So I got my life back together. I'm grandmother. I mean, I just do everything like I used to do.
At the time, did you have children?
Yes, I had two sons. One was still in high school and one had just graduated.
And for your grandchildren, will you tell them the story too about what happened?
Yes, I have. My granddaughter, and now in the Oklahoma City schools, they learn about it. And I've taken her down there, and she got to go on the 20th anniversary and got her picture taken with Clinton. So she does know all about it.
Okay. And do you ever provide any of the energy and the strength that you've had to work through during those events? Do you pass that down to your children and grandchildren?
I try to. I hope I do. I try to get them to realize that if you can't fix something, move on. If you can fix it, do it. I mean, I just try to instill positive things in them.
Prior to the interview, you showed us a sweater. Can you explain to the listeners what that was?
Yes, I always knitted. I used to knit for a woman that would design sweaters, and I would knit for her, and always had my knitting with me. I had a basket of my yarn. I was working on a Christmas sweater. I had it in the office, and I would take my breaks, and I would work on it. After the bombing, the agents went up to the rubble. They were trying to find things that they could salvage, and one of the agents saw my basket all torn up and yarn scattered everywhere, and he started picking it up. Another agent who was not he was from Dallas. He said, she's not going to want all that. He said, no, this is her knitting. So they brought it to me, and I was so happy to see that basket of yarn, and it meant the world to me. But I realized I had lost my joy. I can't knit. I don't want to knit. I don't have any desire. And when I went to the trial in Denver, I heard some of the impact witnesses. And a man got on the stand, and he said, I used to make wooden toys. I made a cradle for my grandson. He said, I can't even work on wood anymore. I'm listening. And then the next woman got up. She had lost her baby. And she said, I used to stay up late at night after I put him to bed, and I would sew. And she made bridesmaids' dresses and things. And she said, I can't sew. I got angry because I realized that's three of us that I know about. They're not going to win. So I went home, and I designed a sweater. I made the sweater. I used yarn that had come out of the building. I have, you know, all the symbols on it, the fence and my guardian angel and red hearts and stars for the three unborn babies that were killed. I don't wear the sweater, but I called it my victory sweater because I'm not letting them win.
So each year I know the museum and the memorial have a ceremony about April 19th. Have you participated in these events? Have you, do you make it out there to those type of events to help support it?
Yes, on the anniversary, in the beginning, it was very difficult for everybody. As the years have gone by, we have become like one big family. We have met the family members of those who died, and we look forward to seeing each other every year. Sometimes the group will get together and there'll be people that go to lunch after the ceremony, but it's like a reunion. It helps all of us.
Some final questions here. I just wanted to ask you if there was anything that you had for the listeners that you might want to impart, any wisdom, any words of encouragement, things that you may have learned or experienced because of the incident.
Going through a trauma, I came out, like I said, I am not going to let them win. So we had some therapists come to the office at Customs. We had some therapists come to the office, and I went to some of the therapist groups. But a lot of them, I could tell, had just read the book. They hadn't experienced anything. So that didn't work for me. And then they sent in a policeman, a policewoman and a fireman who had been through something traumatic. That gave me hope to see, hey, you did it, you made it. So that got me back on my feet to know that somebody else understood what I was going through. When they tell you, that's you tell them something that's going on with you, like a short-term memory, or I'm real depressed, or I'm grieving, and they go, that's normal. I got angry because I grew up wanting to be normal, and if this is normal, you can count me out. So we tell everybody it's a common reaction to a trauma. But my goal is to be the hope for somebody else that has gone through something, and that's what I work on.
You had a Lifetime movie done about you? I mean, word travels a little bit around here in the office, so would you be able to speak on that?
Yes. I was at home, and we would get calls on the answering machine. I know I was asleep, and my husband comes in and said, they're calling about doing a movie. I was like, I'm not about that. So I wouldn't even call him back. And they called like 3 or 4 times, and I just wouldn't even answer the phone. And one time I answered by accident, not knowing it was them. And they wanted to come talk to us, and they wanted to do a movie about somebody who survived and moved on and pulled their life back together. That was what I was about. That caught my attention. I said, okay, well, you can come out and talk to us. I still wasn't, you know, saying I'll do it. Well, when they came out and talked to us, and they only spent a few days with us, just a couple hours here and there. But then the story about one of the firemen who I kept in touch with, they wanted to bring him in because they also wanted to show what the rescuers went through and what their family went through, because it's not easy. It's horrible what you go through. So he was part of the movie as well. But like I said, the only reason I agreed to the movie is I want to give people hope. I want them to know that, you know, you can pull your life back together. It takes a long time, but you got to keep doing it.
And that's something I want to bring up, too, is that you'd spoken about the rescuers, the firefighters who were there. Can you speak to their challenges? I mean, I think when we were hearing from a lot of the people we were interviewing that there was a great deal of challenges that the rescuers had to go through because of the incident.
The part that I can speak of is, I know that, and I went to critical incident workshops and spoke to several of them, but I know that I can remember this one policeman. He was having a very hard time because he had held a woman's hand and she died. And he felt horrible that he couldn't save her, that he couldn't do anything. I always told the rescuers the wonderful peace I had when they took my hand, because it was like, I don't have to worry anymore. Somebody's here with me. I know that if I had died, it would have been like going to sleep, and I would have died with the peace. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, if you held their hand and gave them that comfort, that is the best thing you could have done for them.
I obviously can't experience that, but you know, I can understand it as far as, you know, what you're saying.
Well, I mean, none of us knew whose time it was to go. I mean, they can't prevent it if it's your time. I had I think I felt really bad because we're working law enforcement. We're always told to watch out for briefcases or things, and we kind of expect something can happen. We don't anticipate it, but we know. But you had innocent people going down to Social Security with their little ones, and the people that weren't normally at our building, I hated that for them.
Do you think, kind of asking, changing the subject here, the museum that Oklahoma City has put together, do you think they did justice for those who perished in the incident?
Yes. I was on the committee when they were doing the outside memorial part. I was on the committee that came up with the mission statement. That was a really good healing process for me because it was all raw emotions. We wanted to make sure we included rescuers, family members, survivors in the whole mission. And it was tough. It was tough because we had all raw emotions, but we all came together. And then with the museum, they had, you know, had designers put out something, and the museum is awesome. It's, they set it up kind of like the Holocaust, where it tells the whole story. And once they were able to get the evidence released from the FBI and included it, it's like it tells the whole story. And I think it gives people hope at the end. I mean, they can go through and see what happened and understand better.
Is there any personal words that you'd like to share with the Secret Service?
I just feel like with the Secret Service, it is like one family. And I have been around Secret Service for a long time. I love how they include everybody and look out for each other.
For more information about the Secret Service or how to join, please visit www.secretservice.gov. And until next time, listeners, stay vigilant.